Good morning, is that okay? Okay. So we would say to Yara when we see her, Danke, Shukran, and thank you. That was really wonderful and impressive. And well done to Shahade and Anne-Marie for bringing up their children trilingual, which is just amazing when you think about it. Well, good morning and welcome. Let's just take a moment to pray, and then we'll look at our parable for the day. Thank you, Lord, for being present. Thank you that you have invited us to be part of your kingdom, and that your kingship is grounded in love, in your laying down your life. Help us to be ever aware of your presence, Lord, and of how you're guiding and directing. Help us to hear your voice, both in love, Lord, and in obedience, and to hear, listen, and do what you say. We ask you to bless this time that we have together this morning. In Jesus' name, amen. We have started a new series here. We're just at the midway point on the parables of the kingdom, and I have a PowerPoint. We'll see if it works. I'm that old generation who's trying to, you know, learn how to use some technology, but to figure out how to put a PowerPoint together so that it really projects right is still a challenge, and I have no more young adult children at home to help me. I lost all my tech support. There we go. That's not too bad. Some of this might be a little small, and if the print gets too small, then I'll just read from my notes. So we have the parable of the treasure in the field. It's a single verse. I'll read it to you now, and then we'll just try to take it apart today. This is Matthew 13:44. The kingdom of heaven is like a treasure hidden in a field, which a man found and rehid, covered up. Then in his joy, he goes and sells all that he has, and he buys that field. Now, part of our problem when we come to study things like the parables of the kingdom of heaven and chapter 13 of Matthew is that we've heard them a million times, and we sort of just don't even think about them. And when they asked me if I would do this sermon on a single verse, on a single parable, it was like, what am I going to do with this? Because it's so clear to me what it means without it even being visualized in my mind. You know, it says to me right away, the kingdom of heaven is worth everything that you have in exchange. Let it all go, leave it all behind, and embrace what has been given to you unexpectedly and with great surprise. I mean, that's so clear. But we always have to ask, you know, how did Jesus's listeners, Jesus's followers, the crowds, his disciples, his opponents, how did they visualize and hear this in their context? And what might we tease out of this parable? So before we take it apart, I'd like to just say some background things about Matthew's chapter 13 and his parables of the kingdom of heaven, and a little word, just little background things on shared themes with Mark and Luke, and then things that Matthew goes on to do himself. So we'll go to the next slide, which is a chart. It's a little tiny for you to read, but you can see visually that we have three columns. We have Matthew, we have Mark in the middle, and we have Luke. This is called the kingdom in mystery. And at the top of each column, we see that all three gospel writers tell us the story of the sower and the soils. We usually call it the sower and the seed, but it's the sower and the soils because I think that Gary's sermon on how we are the field, we are the ground, we are the soil in different stages of our life. We are flourishing, and then sometimes we are strangled by worry and or by the cares of this world. I think that was absolutely spot on. So sower and soils. All three share that seed parable. But then, if we look, we see that as a kind of grouping of parables, Mark gives us three. And his are all connected by the idea of seeds. So he has the sower and the soils. He has the seed growing secretly, which is unique, a parable that's unique to Mark and not found in any parallels elsewhere in the New Testament. And then he has the mustard seed. So he and Matthew share the mustard seed. So this focus and this interest and this illustrative background of farming is always there in Jesus' language when he teaches in parables. That's quite often he returns to this theme. And we see three parables about sower, seeds, and soil in Mark. Luke does not share any of those. Luke only tells us the sower and the soils. And the one other parable out of the conglomeration that we have in Matthew that Luke shares is the story of the leaven. And the leaven, of course, was beautifully explained to us last week by Sharon. So Luke is not doing a big thing with sower and soils and seeds. Maybe his audience is a little more urban. I have no idea. We can only guess at reasons that he chooses to do what he does. But look at what Matthew is doing. Matthew begins with the sower and the soils, and then he follows with six more parables, all in a single block of teaching in Matthew chapter 13. So the total parable numbers that we have for Matthew is seven. And if we go to the next slide, as we look at Matthew's kingdom parables that are found in Matthew chapter 13, we see that not only does he give us seven, but as a master teacher who wants us to be able to remember what we have heard, he organizes them for us by giving us kind of a structure. And I've colorized this because I didn't know if you'd be able to read it from where you're sitting, but we can see in the colors, blue and red and green, that beginning at the top with the introductory, the kingdom of heaven is like a sower with his seed who encounters various soils. Then we break down into three groups of two. In today's lingo, this is called twinning. Nowadays, people twin. That's when you do things that match. Like today, if you noticed, Canada was here with her two little girls, and they were twinning today. They all had on black dresses with black hose and black boots. And, you know, not everybody had a flower in their hair, but that would be called twinning in modern lingo. In the language of New Testament or literary studies, it's called chiasm. Which is like, whoa, what does that mean? But it just means that you work on purpose to make a structure in what you're telling so that people can remember it. And the twinning that we see going on in Matthew chapter 13 is based on theme. The parable of the weeds, which is B in blue, and the parable of the dragnet, which is B prime, also in blue, that are like little bookends, they're both about the mixture in the kingdom, the risk throughout the ages until God separates the wheat from the tares, the clean fish from the unclean, and only God himself sees the heart. But they share that same reality that in the kingdom, we're going to encounter all kinds, and God is the one who judges, not us. The mustard seed and the yeast, two small hidden things of tremendous dynamic potential, growing almost unobserved, but taking over hillsides, leavening tons of bread, feeding hundreds and thousands and millions. Huge, huge potential in this quietly moving, expanding kingdom. And the hidden treasure and the pearl. So that was the two red were the mustard seed in the yeast and the treasure and the pearl. Here we're talking, of course, about the supreme value of entering into a relationship with God as king, in becoming part of his kingdom, how this is worth everything. So he gives us that, and as Jesus' hearers in this, as Matthew's readers, who has organized all these words of Jesus, we should be able to remember what we've heard and what we've read, because they're linked together. Even though he spreads them out over a whole chapter, and he turns from one audience to another, so he'll talk to the crowds, and he'll tell them the sower and the soils. He'll talk to his disciples, and he'll tell them the interpretation of that and other parables, especially mixture is very important for them to understand. And as he goes, he turns and he teaches. But together they hang as a group. So as we look today at the parable of the hidden treasure, and we want to ask ourselves, what are they going to be hearing? Now, what really is a parable? I mean, this is Jesus' favorite way to teach, And C.H. Dodd, many years ago, suggested a definition which I find very true still to this day, after lots of centuries of parable work, etc. But he said, at its simplest, a parable is a metaphor or a simile, something that is like to like. It is a metaphor drawn from nature or common life, which is the world that Jesus' audience knows. Most of them come from some type of agricultural or shepherding background. They live in towns and villages. They're not city people. They know what daily struggles are. So it's drawn from nature or common life, and it arrests the hearer by its vividness or strangeness. It's not just any old story, but it's a story that you want to hear. It's a story that you want to stop and think about. That's what a parable is. And things about it are so vivid or so strange that you have to ponder what it means. It leaves the mind in sufficient doubt about its precise application to tease it into active thought. That was my experience over the last few weeks, thinking about this one-line parable, which I knew by heart, but I didn't ever let myself be teased into active thought until now. Okay, so let's pass on to our next slide is the parable which we read, and let us go to the next slide since we already read that. Another little bit of background thought as my mind was teased into thought about this parable, and I hope yours will be today also. Another aspect of thinking about parables is every New Testament scholar wants to bring different kinds of strategies and interpretive methodologies to it, but years ago, John Dominic Crossan, who is a literary scholar of New Testament, in 1974, before the Jesus Seminar was started, I'm happy to say, I think, in a Semeia volume, he talked about the kinds of parables. And I love his suggestion for the four kinds of parables that Jesus teaches. I think it's a really fun thing to ask of a parable. So the first group, he said, are parables of Advent. Now, Advent means to come, right? Advent is coming. And Advent parables are images of mystery and concealment, of gift and surprise, of discovery and joy. In a parable of Advent, something great and wonderful and unexpected happens. A mustard seed produces a crop that takes over a hillside. A little leaven leavens many, many loaves of bread. A man finds a treasure in a field? Perhaps. Ours is a parable of Advent, perhaps. Something so good and so unexpected that you want to cling to it. Next slide. In contrast to the parables of Advent, I think, are really addressed to the crowds, primarily to attract them to come to Jesus' message. In contrast to parables of Advent, we have parables of reversal. Parables in which the coming of the kingdom causes dramatic change, polar reversal. They're world-shattering. They challenge our preconceptions. They say that the first will become last and the last will become first. The hero is an unexpected person, a Samaritan. The rich man, when he crosses over, is in the bad part of Sheol, and the good man is in paradise. Lazarus, the poor man, is in paradise in Abraham's bosom. The Pharisee and the publican pray, and the Pharisee is not justified, but the tax collector is. This is the nature of the kingdom of heaven when it turns things upside down, when its rule is not like human rule. And it's the reversal, that power of change that comes with the kingdom of heaven. The third kind of parable that Crossan suggests are parables of action, parables in which all kinds of activity has to be done, reactions to situations of challenge or crisis that are successful, like the friend at midnight who comes and pounds on the door because a friend has come and he has nothing to feed them. Please get up. And, oh, no, I'm in bed with my kids. I can't get up. But persistence pays off. Or the woman who demands from the unjust judge that she get what she is deserving because her persistence pays off. Successful action. But sometimes they are parables of unsuccessful action. The rich fool looks at his cars and swimming pools and vacation homes and stocks and says, well, maybe tomorrow I'll get up and I'll invest in another stock. And that night he dies and he has nothing because he has not put his treasure in heaven. His action was unsuccessful. Or sometimes you have rarely a parable of both successful and unsuccessful action, such as in the parable of the 10 virgins, where we see five who were ready and brought their oil with them, and five who were not ready for the delay of the bridegroom and whose lamps ran out. So three kinds of parables so far: Advent, reversal, and action. Now, let's see what can we suggest our parable really is. The fourth kind of parable is a paradigm parable. In a paradigm parable, the whole kind of parabolic activity of Jesus is contained. It's a full kingdom parable. It is a parable in which we have the unexpected, our advent, a future hope, something we did not expect to have happen, but it is good. And that unexpected thing overturns our lives. It's reversal. We were going down one road, one trajectory, and now we're going to go down another. Unexpected advent, it overturns our past. It presents us with a future. It overturns our past, and it gives us a new existence if we will act, if we will choose. It changes our present in action. The parable of the hidden treasure, as short as it is a paradigm parable. It has all those elements in it. So let's examine it a little bit. Next slide. Thank you. The story you know so well. A hidden treasure is found. When I first started thinking about this, I overlooked the fact that it was a hidden treasure. A treasure that was not just easily seen, but for some circumstance, the man walking through the field saw it. A hidden treasure. We'll explore this a minute more. And when he finds the treasure, he rehides it. So really, it's a hidden treasure that has become unhidden for some reason. Upon finding it, he rehides it. Then Matthew says that with joy, happily, he goes out and sells everything that he has. He liquidates all his assets. He sells his stocks, he sells his car, he puts his home on the market. To bring together, I mean, I'm using modern terminology, obviously, whatever his assets were then, they were sufficient to buy the field. It is not that he is so impoverished that he can't manage to buy the field, but he has the resources to make the trade of all that is his for something that promises better, for something that promises, well, we would think financial security, material security in this parable, but of course it's a symbol. So he has the ability to make a decision for himself and to act upon it. He approaches the owner and he purchases the field. Okay, so the first thing that really bothered me about this parable is who does this treasure belong to beforehand? Right? If you're walking down the street, you see a wallet, you pick it up, and you try to find the owner. Why doesn't he try to find the owner of this treasure? It was hidden, but it was hidden by whom? The field belongs to someone. The field has an owner. Is this treasure rightly the treasure of the owner? I mean, maybe we're not supposed to ask these questions, but why we should just expect that you come upon something that was purposely hidden and it's okay for it to become yours, or how do you make it become yours? So who is this man? Next slide. Well, we're going to come back to all of these questions and see if we can help resolve some of it. When the hearers of this parable, as Jesus speaks it, when they say the kingdom of heaven is like a treasure hidden in a field which a man found, how should we visualize that man? Is that man a hiker walking through a field on a sunny day who just happens to find a treasure in a field? That's sort of one possible way of thinking about it. Or another discussion that comes up in the commentaries and in the background is he perhaps a laborer who works for the owner? And he's a farmer out farming in a plowed field, because the word is agros, which usually means a cultivated field. But whether the man himself is farming for someone else or whether the person is just passing through a cultivated field, he doesn't own the field. And you would ask then, does he have a right to purchase a field with a treasure hidden in it that was not originally his? So let's look at the possible fields here. The man we don't know, a passerby, a farmer. Next slide. The field, just an open, you know, wandering, hiking hillside like here, or a cultivated field like we have on the right-hand side. It could go either way. We don't really have an indication that is so clear from the text, other than the word agros usually means cultivated field, but they are adjacent to all kinds of communities and settlements, and if it's a cultivated field and it has an owner, everybody knows who it belongs to. Next slide, please. So these pictures are just for fun. And how do we picture this treasure? What does it mean when Jesus' listeners hear that there was a treasure hidden in a field? Are they thinking, like our first thought is, oh, pirate chests, you know, full of goblets and doubloons or coins and jewelry and things like that? That's how we picture it. And so we have fun pictures up there of all kinds of pirate hordes. But or is it one of these? Because we know from archaeology that all kinds of hordes of coins have been excavated in this country, some of them contemporary with Jesus. For example, at Qumran, within the settlement, there was a clay vessel full of Tyrian shekels that had been hoarded by someone and that was left after the Romans came, and nobody ever came back to get that treasure because they didn't live or they didn't have access because of the first revolt against Rome. Just think about all the caves that the Dead Sea Scrolls are found in. All of them except for the few on the peninsula and number 4, but most, Cave 1, Cave 3, Cave 11, Cave 2, Cave 6, they were hiding places for the treasure of these different Jewish groups. Their most important scrolls, their lamps, their fabrics, all different kinds of things. You think of the Bar Kokhba caves. All those documents that belonged to the community and their wealth were hidden in those caves. So to hide a treasure is something that has happened throughout history. And whether it would be a clay vessel with coins or a leather bag with money in it or a box with wealth in it, someone in this parable buried the treasure in the field. Now, a treasure in a field is kind of a stupid place, personally, I would say, to hide a treasure. Because you need a landmark. If you don't have your pirate's map with X marks the spot, how will you find that treasure again? Unless you do put it next to a tree or a marker stone or something, but a treasure hidden in a field is a risky thing. It's an unexpected thing. It's not the place you expect to find treasures. And how do treasures become, how do they become visible once they've been hidden? I think we have the next slide. Well, even today, this is January 2019, Times of Israel. Because of our heavy, heavy rainfalls last month, in two different places in the country, near Beit Shan and up at Akko, people just walking along found ceramic horses' heads that had been exposed because of the rainfall and the soil running off. One of these horses' heads, the one that the ladies found at Bethshan or near Bethshan, dates back to the Iron Age. It's 2,800 years old. The one that the gentleman found near Akko dates back to the Hellenistic era, so it's 2,200 years old. That is treasure not hidden purposely, but treasure that is revealed, archaeological treasure, just because the forces of nature randomly can make it happen. So we can have that happen, and happily she worked for the IAA, so everything's good. All the stuff got handed in to the Israel Antiquities Authority. Nobody has to worry about looting anything. But the rainfall and the forces of nature, or plowing. If this field is a farm field and he is actually working it in and farming and he's plowing along, a hidden treasure could come to light. But he's by himself when he finds this. There's no one else with him. And he looks at it, and he thinks about it, and he knows that this treasure has life-changing potential. So next slide. These are just little thoughts. This is a short but complicated narrative with ethical and moral considerations. It definitely teases us into thinking. The identity of the man and the reason for him being in the field are not specified. Jesus lets us fill in the details. If we were going to make a movie, we would have to commit. But because we're not making a movie and we're just thinking about the words, you can visualize it however you want. He finds the treasure and it will change his life. This is surprise. This is Advent. This is a new future laid before him. Reversal. In joy, he sells all that he has and he approaches the owner of the field. He knows who owns the field. Either he knows personally already or he makes inquiry about that field. He takes his assets. He goes to the owner of the field and he says, "I would like to buy that field." Now, here's the answer of why the owner of the field is not the owner of the treasure. If the owner of the field had planted that treasure, he would not have sold the field to the man. In real life. I mean, this is God, so God will do it. But in real life, if you have buried your treasure in a field and somebody comes and wants to buy that from you, but your treasure is still in the field, you're not going to sell it to him. So that, for me, clarifies that this treasure is open and available for anyone, for everyone, for whoever finds it. That treasure has the potential to be brought into their life and to change their life if they are willing to take the action necessary to possess the treasure. Because the man sells the field to the man who found it. How do we understand this? Well, David Biven did wonderful work on this parable in his book, New Light on the Difficult Words of Jesus, Insights from His Jewish Context. So we're going to first look at what David suggests about how Jesus' followers understood it in the first century when they were listening to him. I think we have to go to the next slide for applications. In its original context, Jesus speaks to his disciples. He stresses the supreme value, the joy, and the satisfaction that come with choosing discipleship. He's called those 12, he's called those hundreds, dozens, finally hundreds, to come with him. Many of them have given up everything. They've given up their jobs. They've given up their family time. They've given up security and stability to walk with him on the way. Walking with Jesus on the way is not an easy thing during his lifetime. They itinerate. They sleep out in the open. They have to find people who will show them hospitality. They have long days and sometimes uncomfortable nights. They do have wonderful reception in many places, but they've given up security in order to become disciples and hear his words. And Jesus reassures them with this parable that they've made the great choice because the reward is going to be so great. It already is, and it will continue to be great. It is worth the exceptional experience of walking with the Master. As Matthew concludes the sermon, by the way, he talks about this process. In Matthew chapter 13, verse 52, he said to them, "Every scribe who has been trained for the kingdom of heaven is like a householder who brings out of his treasure what is new and what is old." Walking with Jesus as a disciple brings treasure. It is treasure. It's the choice of enrichment. It's the choice of joy. It's the choice of allowing God's rule in your life. So they hear in quite a concrete way that their discipleship with him, as difficult as it may be at times, is joy and treasure with eternal value. But of course, Jesus has died and risen. He is no longer on this earth. They are no longer his earth. And how does this parable speak to us who are not actually walking with him, leaving behind our families and our jobs in order to embrace this treasure? So next slide. For we who come after, we are all toiling in this field of life. Every human being is living a life and they're crossing through the fields, they're working in fields, and it's toil. Unexpectedly, we come upon a treasure. How will this treasure come to each one of us and to those we have yet to meet? We don't know ahead of time how Jesus will reveal his love, his power, his compassion, how the message of God's kingdom will come to an individual. But at some point, all of us sitting here have experienced the recognition that that message of Jesus and of the desire of God for relationship, it could be supremely valuable. It could be the thing that changes our lives. It is something very personal. One individual finds the treasure. Jesus has a treasure for each individual. And we each, when we have that surprise of seeing the goodness of God in the face of Jesus, have a decision to make. A decision that will reverse our lives. It will take control of our lives out of our hands. It will reverse our lives. It will be something new. We can go to the next slide. So there's the power of transformation, healing, salvation, sustenance in this thing. But it provokes decision. And it's an all-encompassing decision. Now, Jesus is not going to ask every one of us to sell everything that we have. He's not going to ask every one of us to go live an itinerating life. There are some people who God will call to be business people, benefactors. There will be every kind of career, every kind of expression, because we are infinitely different, infinitely called by God to be used by him in creative ways to bring his love in all kinds of venues and all kinds of situations. It's really about releasing the control. It's really about saying, I want to buy that field for that treasure, and you will guide me. This treasure is going to become the thing that directs our life. This presence of God, in whatever unique way he does it with each of us. But it's of supreme and infinite value because it puts us within his kingdom. It puts us in a place where the Lord promises, in the midst of the hardship, to be present with joy, with healing, with transformation. Paul writes, "We have this treasure in earthen vessels." to show that the transcendent power belongs to God and not to us. And as difficult as that can be, because we know in part and we see in part, and momentary light affliction is producing a far greater weight of eternal glory, we have the treasure. We simply need to take the action to commit ourselves to God's rule and his love and his life and his direction. The rich young ruler in Matthew chapter 19 had exactly the wrong response to this moment of meeting Jesus. He comes to Jesus, he wants to know which things should he do, and he's kept all the commandments since his youth. And so Jesus looks at this young man. It's his moment of being presented with a treasure. And Jesus says, you know, you lack one thing. You can change your life. You can be assured, he says, but you go sell everything that you possess and give it all to the poor, and then come and follow me. And Matthew writes, and the young man walked away sadly, because he had much treasure. But he didn't have the right treasure. He couldn't divest himself of what he thought was most important in life to welcome the treasure that God wanted to give him, the special treasure, the hidden treasure. Shabbat shalom. God bless you.